Hey, this is James from SurvivalPunk.com.
And this is Mike, Still Son's nickname. How you doing today?
Wonderful. Yourself?
Oh, I'm hanging in there, but, you know, I'm actually kind of excited today. We've got yet another one of the people, or in this group, this case, a couple of people that I've invited on with our celebrity invites have actually going to be coming on, and we're going to be talking to them, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy.
Exactly. I've been a fan of their work for many years, so it'll be a great honor to be able to talk to them and pick their brains.
Now, their website was Doom and Bloom, or Bloom and Doom.
I think it's Doom and Bloom.
Doomandbloom.com.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these people literally wrote the book on survival medicine.
Yeah, and sadly, I need to pick up a copy of their book. I had one, and I read it for review and gave it away a couple years ago when I had my September month of preparedness giveaway thing, which I kind of have an idea. I was thinking about doing this, the month of preparedness again this year for September, but I kind of ran out of time. But what I'm thinking about doing is I have some survival stuff that I don't necessarily need anymore.
Okay.
And I'm trying to get rid of some stuff to move on my homestead and downsize my life.
The great new chapter of your life that's about to be opened.
Exactly. So I'm thinking about just doing some giveaways of stuff that I have. So re-gifting stuff to people. And in some cases, there's books that, you know, haven't even been used that I have duplicates of or whatnot. So stay tuned. We'll see how that goes.
Awesome. Now, since this is another one of our episodes in our interview series, we're going to go ahead and get all of our sponsor ads out of the way right at the beginning. That way we can go completely uninterrupted with these fantastic guests. I'm a little bit starstruck again.
Yeah. we are introducing a new sponsor. It's an affiliate sponsor, so if you buy from them, I'll get some money to help fund the homestead, and I hope to be bringing on a new sponsor here in the next few weeks, and actually, for that matter, maybe a few sponsors, because I want to buy a tractor, so I need some money. The first sponsor of the day is JMBullion.com, your home for gold and silver online, the best place, the place that I would go online to buy gold and silver. And if you want a monetary hedge against inflation, then you need especially gold, silver. I don't really mess with too much gold. I've got a couple of little gold coins.
It's definitely the more affordable way to go when you're first starting out.
It's the more common man's. I mean, if you've got spare money, I mean, holding it in gold would not be a bad choice. I mean, you could hold in the palm of your hand, you could hold enough gold to like start a new life.
Exactly.
So, but I like silver. Mm-hmm. It's more affordable. It's easier to get. And then I think you should get it from jmbullion.com. Make sure you go through survivalpunk.com. Click the banner just so they know that you're coming from me.
Precious metals are always a very wise
investment. Yes, and they have free shipping.
Free shipping. Plus you get, does that come with the Survival Punk Army membership, the free shipping?
JMBullion, no, it's just by themselves, yeah.
All right. But if you are a member of the Survival Punk Army, what do you get from JMBullion?
I don't have nothing from JMBullion.
Nothing from JMBullion?
No, but our next two sponsors, you do get something from.
Oh, yeah, I got completely confused on that.
Yep. Okay. The next is SurvivalGearBags.com. Kelly John Doe over at SurvivalGearBags.com. Amazing family-run business. That sprouted up from the survival community. Survival gear bags really popped up because Kelly saw a need in the market for good quality survival gear bags and gear to put in those. A lot of the commercial people on the internet that have like pre-made survival gear bags really are just full of garbage. And Kelly wanted to provide better quality gear for the community. So check out survivalgearbags.com. Make sure you click the banner.
Right-hand side of the screen at SurvivalPunk.com.
And if you are a Survival Punk Army member, and I do hope you are, just to briefly put that in there, Survival Punk Army helps support the things that we do here. You could get it for $50 a year, $5 a month, different pricing options. You get exclusive content, discounts, and some ebooks and whatnot. So good stuff there. There'll probably be some good homesteading stuff we'll add exclusively for you guys later, and it helps support what we do.
Just remember, the Survival Punk Army wants you!
Yes, and Survival Gear Bags offers 10% off discounts to everything. And then, lastly, but not leastly, is Well Food Co. John Wellborn and his wife over there have an amazing company of paleo-friendly foods that you can get. I've tested a bunch of their stuff. Their carne bars, their paleo MREs, which, I mean, obviously I don't have to explain to you guys why you'd want paleo MREs. Better quality food. Take it out on missions. Take it out on camping trips.
I've never heard of hikes. I've never heard of a paleo MRE.
They invented them.
Really?
They invented the paleo MRE with Rob Wolf. And the carne bars are pretty amazing. I really like those.
Huh.
Cookies and snack foods and stuff. Chocolate bars. All paleo friendly. Grass fed. Wow. Organic. Best quality you can get. They do I want to say a 15% discount if you're a Survival Punk Army member.
50%?
15.
15, oh. Okay.
50%, I'd be ordering them blind. yeah, but 15% off all orders there. So that's another reason to join the Survival Punk Army. And then great food, great people. Make sure you go through the banner.
Oh, they have a banner too now?
They have a banner on the main website and in the bottom of every other post. So
awesome. Find the banner. Click on it.
Click on it. Buy something. Enjoy.
Well Food Co.
And with that, we will wrap up the intro section at only 6 minutes. And we'd like to introduce Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy to the show.
We are fantastic. Thank you so much for inviting us, James and Mike.
I'm glad to be here.
We're very grateful that you agreed to come on. I can already tell this is going to be a great interview.
And put up with the numerous internet problems.
Let's not talk about them anymore. The gods smited us last time. So, yeah. Uh-huh. All right. Okay. Well, for those out there who are unfamiliar, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, they actually wrote the book on survival medicine. They have a very popular website. What's it called again, guys?
Doomandbloom.net.
Doomandbloom.net. Yes. Like I said, for those out there who are unfamiliar, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, how did you meet and how did you first get interested in disaster prep?
Well, I'm a medical doctor, and I worked in the state of Florida as a OBGYN until I retired. Nurse Amy is a certified nurse midwife. We both still have our licenses. And she joined my practice, many years ago. And
many years ago.
And we were one of the first practices in the state of Florida to actually combine medical doctors with holistic nurse midwives.
Well, the problem was the doctors feared us allied practitioners, which is what they tried to, you know, sort of degrade us and put us in. Yes. But Dr. Bones was one of the ones that understood and respected our education and our knowledge and really felt that it was mutually beneficial to have nurse midwives and physicians working in the same practice. So that's how that. And been happily together ever since. And as far as starting preparedness, do you want to answer that question, honey?
Yeah, I guess I would have to say that after Hurricane Katrina would be when we really got interested in it. We experienced so many deficiencies in our national emergency response in that disaster. I mean, and this was despite the best efforts of hundreds of disaster medical assistance teams that were converging on the area. We found that there was a real need for medical education for the average person, that the medical personnel that went to Hurricane Katrina just couldn't get to some people in time to save them. And so we looked around and we saw there were so many different disasters. Look at the disasters that have just occurred in the last couple of years, Hurricane Sandy, tornadoes up and down Tornado Alley, wildfires in Texas, earthquakes in California, floods in Colorado and other places. I'll admit, maybe that the chances that you personally might be affected by any one disaster might be small in a given year, but what's the chance you'll never be affected by a disaster during your lifetime?
Unlikely.
Or your children's lifetime. Exactly. Not so small. So it's very possible that the average person might be the caregiver for the sick and injured in a disaster setting. So it pays to know how to deal with injuries and illness. And nobody that was a doctor, at least, or an advanced registered nurse practitioner was talking about this. And if they were, it wasn't medicalese, it wasn't in English. So we decided to write medical preparedness topics.
We just started with a blog,
and
a podcast.
Right, and put everything that we said or wrote in a way that the average person, non-medical professional, would be able to understand it in plain old English. And be more medically prepared.
And then that just grew into the book. But I would even say earlier, as far as preparedness for myself, because my dad was very self-reliant. He was in the Air Force. We lived out in the country in Georgia. We had some acreage and we grew food. My mother canned. I remember very clearly the gas shortage, and my dad got this giant barrel and made like his own gas station for our cars and drove motorcycles. And so we had to be very frugal, not just because he wasn't making much money as an airline mechanic at Eastern, but because it was just, you know, smart, and my parents liked to save money. So, and then we lived also through Hurricane Andrew in 1992. So, you know, some of these things, it builds up, and then suddenly you that real strong light bulb comes on, and you say, okay, I have to get going right now.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds good. So we're gonna jump into the next question here. What are some of the most basic things you can do to get yourself healthy to better survive a disaster?
Well, I think that the first thing you'll have to do is put together some type of community, even if it's your own extended family. You know, there are a lot of rugged individualists in the preparedness community, and they might survive as lone wolves, but I'll tell you, it would be a miserable existence. There are just too many things to do to keep it together for one person to accomplish without becoming absolutely exhausted, becoming weak, losing their natural ability to mount immune defense to germs that they'll be exposed to in a disaster setting or survival setting. I mean, think about it, chopping wood, lugging water around, patrolling a perimeter, standing watch. Boy, these are things that take energy. If you're going to try to do it all by yourself, you probably are going to fail. So it just makes common sense to have a group of people together that are going to share these responsibilities. Now, the next thing that you should do, of course, is something that your doctor probably has told you a million times. Keep a normal weight for your height and age, and get good nutrition, stay fit, get rid of those bad habits, and get whatever. One thing he may not have told you is to get whatever medical issues that you have dealt with while we have modern technology. For example, I was a very nearsighted person in my youth, but I decided when I realized that we might be getting into trouble that I was not going to be able to function if I ever lost my glasses or my contact lenses dried out. So I had that LASIK procedure, and now I have the eyes of an eagle, an extremely elderly eagle, a very old eagle,
but still don't believe it,
an eagle.
Guys.
So if you've got a bum knee, if you've got some issues that would negatively impact your ability to survive or succeed,
get them fixed
when everything else fails,
yep,
then get them fixed now.
Yeah, that's here at Survival Punk. We do a lot of we put a big emphasis on getting healthy, getting fit, and just trying to overall be healthy. I really like that you guys are pushing that as well. Those are some key points that we like to hit on here. Is, you know, there's a lot of people in the survival industry that are super overweight, and I just don't feel that. I mean, that's counterintuitive for survival, period, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, I am not super overweight, and I wish you'd put that.
Well, it's hard to walk the walk sometimes.
But I will say one thing, that, I mean, not being morbidly obese, but being somewhat chunky, we'll say, may have slight advantages when it comes to deprivation of calories. So those of us that have a few extra pounds, you know, might not be so bad, because we will get fit, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
See, James, I'm a survival camel.
You're there more
you
than
that.
There you go.
All right. Now, well, as we mentioned earlier, you literally wrote the book on survival medicine. It's called The Survival Medicine Handbook. And could you tell us a little bit about it? And it's my understanding you got a second edition coming out. Is there anything new in there?
Well, yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about the book. The book is a medical and first aid book. It teaches a non-medical professional how to deal with medical issues in disasters when modern medical help is not available. And so this book is different, and the second edition of the book is also different.
Right,
because,
which is out already.
Right,
this is the second,
right,
yeah.
Which, because the book assumes that there are no hospitals, there are no doctors, and that you are now where the buck stops in an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And so The book's different from other books because from the front cover to the back cover, the book never tells you to go to the doctor, never tells you to go to the hospital. What? Well, because the book assumes that they no longer exist as an option for you because a collapse has occurred or some major disaster. And even wilderness survival books, of which there are a lot of good wilderness survival medicine books, are based on the ability to stabilize and transport patients to hospitals. And when you can't do that, you need a new mindset and a lot of new strategies if you're going to keep your family safe. And that's what the book's all about. The second edition is 150 pages longer than the original. It's got twice the illustrations. It covers a lot more hardcore topics like mass casualty incidents, tracheotomy, amputation, closing wounds, other issues that most books won't address at all, at least to non-medical professionals. And has a really expanded section on how to use medicines like antibiotics to prevent those unnecessary deaths from like simple things during the activities of daily survival, like cutting yourself while chopping wood, that can become infected and can lead to life-threatening conditions.
Now, do you have any good herbal alternatives to antibiotics that you could suggest to our listeners?
Well, Amy is the herbal person here, and she loves that. We like to integrate regular medicine with alternative medicines, and so she's got a few options for you.
I'd have to say one of my very favorites is garlic. And if you are even thinking about becoming prepared, you know, it's a good thing to store seeds up, but that's not going to help you if you want to plant garlic. You need to start that now. And you need to get some cloves and you need to get it going because this is something that you can eat every day. You can add it to your diet. You'll be a healthier person. And you can keep it going. You save some of those bulbs to keep planting again to the next season. They store very well. And the best way to use garlic is fresh. So, you know, it's one thing to get garlic powder or garlic salt or, you know, there's different ways of having it for long-term storage. But there's nothing that beats fresh garlic for being a powerful antibiotic and antiviral. And what you do is you take one clove, crush it up, put it on a spoon. You can put it in a tablespoon if you want. And then fill that spoon up with some raw unprocessed honey. You have now got two different herbs or products that are going to help you fight infection. So I love both of those. And combining them, it couldn't be better. Some other ones are grapeseed extract. That is something that is very difficult to make at home. I've read some home recipes for it, but it's almost like an industrial secret as to exactly how they extract and which parts. They're pretty sure it's the seeds, but exactly how they do it has been very difficult to find out. So buy some grape seed extract to store. Ginger is another thing. Again, if you can plant ginger, ginger likes a warmer, moister environment like we have down here in South Florida, but that doesn't mean you can't bring your plant indoors when it gets a little cool outside. And then when it warms up, you can take it back outside. So ginger is another really wonderful thing. And there are a lot of different herbs that do have these same kind of properties. So, you know, get used to it. Maybe plant some eucalyptus if you can. Again, eucalyptus is something you can bring inside. Juniper is great. Something called wormwood. So there are a lot of different herbs out there that can replace. Now, I'm not saying they're as effective, although, you know, there are people that will tell you garlic is just so amazing. And one thing about the raw and processed honey, there are situations with skin infections that are resistant to almost every antibiotic out there, but they're not resistant to raw and processed honey. So if you have something called MRSA on your skin, you can use raw and processed honey as a treatment when those antibiotics might not be effective.
That was exactly, I'm glad you mentioned that. What brought up this question and what I usually ask people like yourself and Dr. Bones, a couple years ago I did some primitive camping outside. So I had a lean-to, and I was camping outside, and I got a bug bite. And I scratched at it with my dirty fingernails, and I got immersive oil on my leg.
Yep.
It was the worst thing ever. It was like I had the flu and a giant, nasty blister on my leg, and I had to take antibiotics for that. And I try to avoid antibiotics, you know, for gut bacteria issues altogether, and I didn't know, like, if that happens during a disaster, I could imagine people getting bug bite, bitten, and I imagine their fingernails will be even more disgusting than normal.
Right.
Getting immersive oil in a disaster could be life-ending. I mean, I don't know how far it'd go, but...
No, you're right.
...incapacitated for a week or so.
No, you're absolutely right. Like an expert off the Walking Dead.
Yeah, exactly. And the problem with those infections, if they don't get treated properly, is they get into the blood system.
Yeah.
And then you get septicemia, and this is something that will happen more frequently because of the lack of modern medicine and the lack of antibiotics and the lack of knowledge of even what to do, even how to clean this simple scratch or cut appropriately. So, I mean, this is part of what we're trying to do to prevent these small things. And you talk about a bug bite, I mean, this is a small little thing, and it turned into this giant problem for you.
Yeah.
Right. That's why I wrote the first article about fish antibiotics, because I saw that there were going to be a lot of what I would consider to be unnecessary deaths as a result of people just doing a lot of stuff on a daily basis that they're not used to doing. I mean, they're not going to be used to cutting wood or making fires, perhaps, doing a lot of other things in the outdoors, if that's where they are going to have to bug out to. And I saw a lot of people dying from simple infected cuts, things that could be dealt with if the person had only prepared by having a supply of antibiotics.
Excellent. So next we're going to jump right into the main topic of this show, which is Ebola. So let's pretend that someone knows nothing about Ebola.
Have to pretend. That's me.
Yeah, Mike knows nothing about Ebola. He has not been watching the news. So tell Mike, who knows nothing about Ebola, the generics. Like, what is it? What are the symptoms? How does it spread?
Is it curable or treatable? Anything like that?
Yeah. You got it. We'll go A to Z here.
Let's get started then. The Ebola virus is a microscopic organism. It looks like a little string of looks like a little string if you look at it under the microscope. It's one of the three members of the Filoviridae virus family. There are several known varieties. The one that has caused the current epidemic is a variant of what we call the Zaire strain. It was first reported in 1976 in Zaire, which is now called the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that's where the first epidemic resulted in 400 and something deaths out of 600 known cases. Now, Ebola, I don't know if you know this, but Ebola is named after the river where the first victims were identified, the Ebola River. So what's the big deal? I mean, why should an epidemic in Africa matter to citizens of countries like ours, you know, thousands of miles away? You know, cases of the epidemic are so far, at least in this country, few and far between, and in Europe and other civilized countries. Well, I mean, this outbreak that's happening right now, it's not in the deep, isolated parts of Africa like all the other outbreaks have been. It's on the West Coast, which is much more populated, and it's a much more easily traveled area. As a matter of fact, there are going to be 10,000 people from the epidemic zone that are going to be traveling to the United States in the next 3 months, at least on average, and they will enter through Houston, Atlanta, and New York. And so with air travel around the globe possible in just 24 hours, I mean, this virus is something that could travel fast. So it just simply makes sense to be aware of it. There are a number of animals that are thought to carry the virus. Fruit bats like flying foxes, they're thought to be the likely vectors of transmission. But that doesn't seem to get them really ill. Who it does get ill, are humans and non-human primates, gorillas, and chimpanzees. So, I mean, how could we possibly have gotten the virus in the first place? Well, guess what? These people eat in West Africa or in Central Africa. They eat bats and they eat monkeys and they eat antelopes that might have eaten grass that had bat droppings on it. And this is most likely how this all first got started. Now, how can you get it and how can you not get it? By the way, I just want to tell you one thing before we go much further. What we're not going to tell you on this show today is to panic. And the reason why we prepare is it's not out of fear or desperation. We prepare out of hope that there's an answer to any disaster if we have planned for it before it happens. And so we're just passing along information that will keep your listeners informed and give you guys the best chance of reaching preparedness goals. So, you know, I just want everybody to know your most important survival tool, that's your mind, okay? Use it to do your own research, come to your own conclusions, and figure out if what I'm saying is right, but this is my viewpoint on it. So how can you get it and how can't you get it? I think that is the big key here. So there are several methods that of transmission of the virus, and one of them is eating infected animals. As I mentioned, that's how I think it all started. You can't get Ebola, however, just from simply eating food at the same table as someone who has it. And remember that drinking water from a water source in an area that happens to have Ebola patients also, at least right now, is not thought to be a way that you can get it as well. So you can drink the same water the water from the same area, and you theoretically can eat food that has been normally prepared, you know, at the same table as an Ebola patient without getting Ebola. That's what the Center for Disease Control says.
Having said that, though, if I was getting my water from a lake or a pond and there was a dead Ebola patient floating in it, I probably wouldn't be drinking that water without doing something serious to it.
You're absolutely right.
However, our water through our tap is usually chlorinated,
right,
which helps to destroy it. So think about where your water's coming from.
Right. So the answer is the water chlorinated? Has it been through
treated,
a treatment
right.
plant? If the water has been treated so that it's safe to drink, it should have also killed the Ebola virus. Now, another way you can get the Ebola virus is by inhalation. If you breathe in droplets of blood spatter or vomit droplets or saliva from an infected patient, you can possibly get Ebola. I mean, you can't get it by simply breathing the same air in the room that somebody is with Ebola happens to be in.
So basically what we're saying, if you were on an airplane and the person was, you know, 20 rows in front of you, just because you were on that airplane with them doesn't mean you'll get it. Now, if you were next to them or in front of them and they were coughing blood or sneezing,
just even
blood,
the saliva or saliva.
Saliva. Some, you had some contact with their fluids in some way. Yes, you can get Ebola from that.
Now, there are some of your listeners that are following this may have read about a study in which they put pigs, injected them with Ebola, put them in cages in the same room as a bunch of monkeys in cages. And apparently some of the monkeys got Ebola. And so they think that was proof of air transmission. That's a Canadian study from 2012, but I noticed that somebody put it up, some news service put that up today.
As if it was new.
But it was evaluated by the CDC at that time, and they decided that there just wasn't enough evidence that air transmission in and of itself was part of the issue. In other words, there may have been droplets, you know, pigs may have sneezed onto the monkeys or something like that, and may have caused it that way. Of course, another way you can get it is by handling a needle that has been used on an Ebola patient or a syringe or other medical supplies. That's probably what's happening in a lot of these West African countries where infection precautions aren't so good, is that healthcare workers and other people are handling some of this stuff, even not to inject into themselves, but to throw it away and not doing a good job keeping it
isolated
and decontaminated.
Right. In a hazardous waste container,
right,
which they probably run low on.
Right. So that's another thing, another way to get it. Absorption. Now, by touching secretions from an infected individual, even sweat, and then touching your mouth or your eyes or an open sore, that could possibly cause you to get it. In and of itself, just sitting next to someone on a that has Ebola is not going to give you Ebola. But if you happen to touch an open sore, your mouth or eyes after touching their sweat or saliva, things like that, you can get it.
So what now, we're saying is it has to get into your body.
Somehow. Now, this may not be as rare as you think, because look at one of your kids for a half hour. Count the number of times they touch your face or pick at a scab or something like that. And you'll see that actually might just be a possibility if you really see how often people just can't keep their hands from their faces. Ebola can be transmitted sexually, and the amazing thing about that is that the semen of an infected male is contagious for up to 7 weeks, even if that person recovered from the virus, recovered from the illness. Like that person got ill with Ebola and is one of the percent of people that will survive it, they still can infect you sexually with their semen for 7 weeks afterwards. And, of course, and also they found that mothers pass it from the baby to the fetus during pregnancy. So that's how you can and how you can't get it. So once you're infected with the Ebola virus, there's going to be a period of time that'll exist before you develop symptoms. This is called the incubation period. You probably have heard about that. It ranges about, I guess, for 2 to 21 days before you start getting symptoms. Now, the majority of researchers don't believe you're contagious before you develop symptoms. If you have just been infected, that you shouldn't be contagious right away. But there are some cases where the source of contagion is uncertain. So the jury may be out on that. But for now, we're saying that if somebody has the virus but doesn't have symptoms, they probably are not going to be contagious at that, for that moment at least. Ebola is a type of hemorrhagic fever. There are a number of different kinds of hemorrhagic fever. What that does is it basically starts off with flu-like symptoms, and then your blood loses the ability to clot normally, especially as the cases advance. The majority of deaths, however, don't actually occur as a result of bleeding. They actually occur more from dehydration, multiple organ failures, because these people are sick. I mean, if you see these people in the very early stages, you might think that you're just looking at somebody that happens to have the flu. I mean, they'll have headaches, they'll cough, they'll sneeze, nose will be running, things like that. As the disease progresses, other weird things start happening, though. People start getting diarrhea, they vomit, they'll have abdominal pain. Some people will develop altered mental status, they'll become groggy, they may have seizures, and of course they'll have different kinds of hemorrhages.
Hemorrhaging under the skin. It almost looks like rashes.
Right, and that can happen in an area where they've had an injection, for example, or it could just happen spontaneously. That's what's scary about it. You just spontaneously start bleeding. You can bleed from your nose, you can bleed from your eyes, you can bleed from your ears. And
yes, this all sounds scary, but we're giving you this information so that you have knowledge. Not trying to frighten you. This is just the way it is.
Right. Here's some good news. Okay.
The facts, man.
All right. Now here's some good news. Okay. So we've given you a lot of the scary stuff. Now here's some good news. The Ebola virus can be killed with simple old soap and water.
Yay.
I mean, just wash your hands, and before and after you deal with anybody that has these issues, and take some other precautions. We're going to tell you about the supplies that you should have as well. And the virus is not something that is like some super virus that just can't be killed. You can kill it with soap and water. You can kill it with chlorine bleach, which is a great option for cleaning countertops, surfaces, items used by people that are sick.
A good mixture of the bleach to your water is 1.5 cups per gallon. And Mike and James, we've just been talking on. Do you guys want to ask a question of what we've talked about so far, or do you need to take a break or something?
Oh, no, not at all.
You're okay.
The only thing I wanted was, I know I'd heard speculation that it is airborne, and you guys put it out that, you know, it's not, but if you sneeze or cough, and I remember watching a Mythbusters thing where they showed, like, how far particles go when you sneeze.
Yeah, how far a sneeze can actually travel.
Kind of scary, yeah. If you think they're spreading Ebola with a sneeze like that, what was it, 20 feet or something or more?
Something like that, but yeah, that's not exactly airborne. Like, I mean, it's like they said, it transmits through fluids, and those, even though those can fly
very far through the air. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So if someone sneezes in the opposite direction of where you're standing, it's unlikely those organisms are going to fly into your face, but everyone who's in front of them is, you know, going to have some trouble. So it just depends on where you are and what's going on.
So I guess that the big question is, so why have so many people died from Ebola? In reality, if you consider how many people have died from Ebola and consider how many people have died in that same area where the epidemic is, from malaria, from tuberculosis, from even just plain old diarrhea not related to Ebola, it's a lot more, there are a lot more deaths from those things than there have been from Ebola. But the question is that because Ebola has such a high death rate, why is that? Why have so many people died from it? And these are modern times, and so many of us, especially in the U.S., think that, you know, the infection precautions that are in our hospitals are the same types of infection precautions or disease precautions that are in other hospitals. But I can tell you from people that have worked there that infectious disease precautions in some areas of those underdeveloped countries, they're just not as advanced as they should be. They don't understand the concept of real effective quarantine. The people that live there have a natural suspicion against health workers, or in some areas, health workers have been driven off with knives and machetes
because they've been blamed for bringing the disease. You're bringing this to us. We don't want you to come help us. So they drive out the healthcare workers. They also don't have enough supplies. They have a real lack of the personal protection.
And it's breaking. Supplies. And it's right now. It's beginning to break down even worse because there have been deaths out of proportion of the normal population among the healthcare workers that have been dealing with these Ebola patients, probably because of these deficiencies in infection control precautions. And it's not. It's caused a lot of. Lately, in the last few days, issues with absenteeism. It's all but closed a couple of major hospitals in the country of Liberia. And, of course, less healthcare facilities is going to equal more deaths. So Ebola isn't done there, but a lot of it is related to what has been happening in terms or what the culture has been over there in terms of their attitude towards infectious diseases and their ability, the amount of money they can spend to controlling infection.
All
now,
right.
Let's see. I'm looking here, I think.
Yeah, we should talk about supplies, honey, about what.
All right. Okay, sure, absolutely. All right, I just want to say one thing about the infected Americans that were brought to CDC headquarters in Atlanta. You know, I can certainly understand.
Question.
Oh,
yeah,
a question like that? Okay, good. Well,
yeah, well
I can
certainly. Go ahead. On our board right now.
Yeah,
oh, okay. All right. Well, I can certainly understand the desire of infected Americans and their families wanting to be brought back to the United States for care, especially after what I just told you about the conditions in Africa. The amount of resources we have here compared to over there, they're enormous. If anyone can control the spread of the disease, we're going to be able to. But I would have felt, this is just a personal feeling, I would have felt a little more secure if we had brought some of that high technology to West Africa. If we had brought the best equipment over there to treat the infected Americans over there, giving them pretty much about the same quality of care. You know what? That equipment, after those Americans got better, would still be there to help all the Africans that have Ebola. I'll bet there are a lot of people in Africa that wish they could be airlifted out to a state-of-the-art medical facility. And I'm sure that there's going to be some resentment among the people there of the special treatment that a lot of the foreigners are getting, or foreigners to them, at least. Now, before the show ends, I really want to talk about what you need to do in terms of getting your act together. There are experimental drugs that they're using that are promising, but they're not FDA approved. They're not going to be prescribable by your doctor anytime soon. So what can you do? I think your plan should start with a strategy to isolate infected individuals from the healthy people in your group. have a designated sick room at one end of your retreat or your camp. The sick room needs bedding, utensils, other items. It's going to be reserved for the sick. I have a great article, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, on the survival sick room at doomandbloom.net, so check that out.
It actually is a really good article.
And once you have your sick room in order, you're going to need supplies, okay? Now, what I want you to have is I want you to have things to wear and things to use. The things you're going to wear and you're going to put them on in this order, you're going to have coveralls. Because it's something that covers your entire body. They can come nowadays with head and shoe covers as well. They're sort of built in. Special masks called N95 or N100 masks. These are masks that filter out 95 or 100% of particles that can be expelled in your direction. And N95s are relatively inexpensive. The N100s are not, I will tell you. They are expensive.
Yes,
but
they are.
So N95s, most people believe, are acceptable for use in these situations. Then you're going to put on goggles. Remember, if somebody sneezes or splatters blood in your direction, gets in your eye, you can get a disease.
And also remember the goggles. You want to specifically get the ones that say indirect ventilation. Indirect ventilation. Because they are splash proof. What happens is you have ventilation, but it's on the top of the mask. And not directly in the front. And some of them, you'll see they have holes all over them. You don't want those. Look for indirect ventilation. And also an anti-fog coating. Those are the two things the CDC recommends that you get for goggles.
Nitrile gloves are good. Nitrile is a hypoallergenic version of polymer. There are a lot of people that are now allergic to latex. And so I'm...
Right.
Recommending that you not get latex gloves, you get nitrile.
But get some thick ones. Don't get these cheap ones you can get for, you know, $400 for $5 at these big box stores. Get some quality ones if they're the ones you're going to use in the room with the sick patient.
All right. One good brand is called Venom.
Venom has got a nice thick black nitrile glove. But, you know, use those cheap ones everywhere else. But if you're going to be going into a room with an Ebola patient, you want the best you can get.
Of course, aprons might be helpful. Some duct tape would be good in order to sort of wrap, you know, the edges of, let's say, the sleeve of your coverall and the glove, just to put an additional seal there.
And make sure the glove goes up over the wrist of the coverall so that the glove is covering the bottom of the coverall on
right.
the wrist.
Absolutely.
You want it to overlap. And then you'll see in these pictures of these people taking care of Ebola patients, they've also wrapped the duct tape there to even seal it better, and sometimes they wrap their ankles. And for shoes, if you don't have the built-in shoe covers with the coveralls and you're just using the little booty shoe covers, make sure that you're wearing like rubber galoshes. You want surfaces that are easily cleaned, your goggles, and those boots are going to be washed with soap and water, and then you're going to soak them in this bleach solution of the 1.5 cups of bleach to 1 gallon of water for at least 10 minutes. And when you take them out, do not rinse that solution off. You let it air dry outside in the sun.
Hmm. That's right. Now,
speaking, that would be a mistake that a lot of people would make.
Yep.
Now, wait, before we're done, I have a few things I need for you to also get that you're going to, and these are things that you use, and that's going to be lots of hand sanitizers, alcohol, BZK wipes, benzalkonium chloride. Hazardous waste bags, get a lot of those. You need a lot of tissues and other things for people to use. Of course, soap and water and chlorine bleach, as we mentioned previously, that's going to be important. You need a thermometer in order to monitor the progress of your patient's fever. And you know what you need? You need a noisemaker. You know, why would you need a noisemaker?
A bell, a whistle, something that's...
Right, and why is that? Because these people are exhausted. If you look at, if you've seen a video of an Ebola patient, they are out of it.
They're so weak.
They probably are too exhausted to call out. So you give them something so that, give the infected person something that they can rattle.
A tambourine.
Or anything. I don't know about a tambourine,
anything.
But anything.
Something that makes noise.
Hey. so that you, so they're comforted to know that you'll be able to hear them when they need you. And so that's something that very few people, you probably have never heard that recommended for a sick room, but that is, in my opinion, something that's important.
They probably won't be able to use a walkie-talkie, but they might be able to shake a bell or something.
Right.
And some, here's some medications.
Right, that's right. Honey. That's right. You absolutely need to have some medications, fever reducers and like Tylenol, acetaminophen, pain relievers, also like Tylenol. You notice I didn't mention Advil or ibuprofen because these things, or aspirin, because these things can be blood thinners, and you've got somebody here who might just be already not clotting their blood to begin with. So I prefer Tylenol in that case.
Tylenol.
Of course, you're going to want to treat all their other symptoms. If they have a runny nose, you're going to give them decongestants like pseudoephrine or phenylephrine, antidiarrheal medications like loperamide, that's Imodium in the U.S. You want natural immune boosters, vitamins, and
zinc, vitamin C, selenium.
Right. Those are also good. And these people are going to be dehydrated, so you're going to want an oral dehydration solution. And, of course, you can either get the commercially available oral rehydration salts, or you can make your own at home with a liter of water.
All right, so get paper and pen.
Write this down. 6 to 8 teaspoons of sugar per liter, 1 teaspoon of salt per liter, 1/4 to 1/2 teaspoon of that salt substitute they sell at the supermarket. That's that people with high blood pressure use and are not supposed to use salt, but like the taste of it. That has potassium in it. And so put a 1/2 or 1/4 teaspoon of salt substitute in there and 1/4 teaspoon of baking soda for bicarbonate. And if you've got a kid that needs that, then I want you to put that combination in 2 liters of water.
Okay.
And there you have it.
I've got so there's not necessarily a cure. It sounds like mostly you're treating symptoms and just trying to make the person try to keep them healthy so they can fight off the infection. Is that right?
You're absolutely right, and that's
not
one,
a cure.
And that is one thing that in theory they are saying that if this starts to spread in the U.S. because we have better medications, we have more IV solutions. We have more intensive care for treating these different problems, that they're more likely to survive, and that our death rate here would not be the same numbers as they're having over in West Africa, which is a very hopeful thing if you think about it. I have seen several Ebola patients in, you know, these news clips that don't have IV hanging, and then you see some that are maybe in more of a hospital setting and they do have IVs hanging. So is the care that they're getting so minimal that they're just dying more frequently? And because we do have knowledge and equipment to be able to treat all of these things as they happen, you're going to have a much higher chance of surviving this. So it's possible that, you know, this 55 to 90% death rate would be lower here. And I think that's, you know, something to hope for.
And hopefully they'll fast-track these experimental serums that they're giving to the 2 infected Americans in Atlanta. The one that shows the most promise is called ZMAP. It's a type of antibody that is produced through from antibodies with mice. And they infuse human cells with these mouse antibodies. The mouse has been injected with Ebola. They produce antibodies. It's fused with the human cells, and the human cells produce the mouse antibodies. It's one of those bioengineering kind of deals, and it seems to show promise. But as I mentioned before, the FDA approval process is a long process, so hopefully they'll fast-track things.
All right, so it sounds like possibly Ebola is not as big a concern as some of the kookier and the survival element are trying to put out. That if an outbreak did happen here in the United States, like from people being brought to Atlanta, just the overall healthy and better medical conditions here, we probably might not have it wouldn't be that big of an issue.
Well, that is our scientific theory. Obviously, it's not a proven theory, but looking at the isolation precautions versus West Africa, nobody's perfect. I will tell you, I've seen doctors and nurses that don't wash their hands when they should, who didn't put on proper precautions when they should, you know, mistakes happen. Nobody's perfect. No, you know, as much as the CDC touts themselves as perfection, there's no such thing. So there is human error, but there's going to be much less because the education and the knowledge of the medical professionals here is much higher. We have more equipment. I think we're so at alert that they're looking for this and they're going to get them in isolation very quickly. So, you know, and it's not as easily spread as people are led to believe. If you're just near somebody, these people are bathing their dead. They're not taking care of them properly. Things are not being disposed of properly. Those gowns that you see are probably not going into the hazardous bags without being touched on the outside. I mean, just there's a lot of bad things going on over there that hopefully will not happen here.
You have to remember the weather there. I mean, it's 100 degrees all the time there. And these people are wearing outfits to cover them from head to toe. So if there's, it wouldn't surprise me if there's been some corners cut with regards to that.
Right.
And I'm sure that it's cost some people dearly.
They could be reusing those disposable coveralls. They could be reusing their respirator N95 or N100 mask. Maybe they're not washing them with the certain amount of bleach that they should be, or letting them soak for enough time. I mean, there's so many things that could go wrong over there, and it probably is leading to a higher outbreak and death rate.
But you know who is going to do okay in an Ebola epidemic?
Preppers.
Jeff and Mike, I was about to say the people that listen to your show, because
right.
They just heard all of the things that you need to do to stay safe during this type of epidemic.
That's right.
Isolation.
Yes, that's what I was just going to mention.
A good sick room, some simple supplies that aren't terribly expensive that will kill the virus and that will protect the people that are taking care of other people that are sick. And these are the things that we've talked about today on your show. And so if people have been listening, I think they'll have a great chance of keeping it together, even if everything else falls apart.
Excellent. I guess I've got probably one more question, and then I'll let you guys get back to it or so. Besides Ebola, is there anything on the map that you guys are worried about that needs to be looked at?
Well, there are a few things that are an issue to me. There are a lot of diseases that are crossing the border with Mexico, and it's just really hard for me to imagine what's going to come around. I know that tuberculosis has passed through
lots of scabies,
right. and things like that. And so it's very possible that we're not doing as good a job as we could in keeping track of what's coming across the border into the U.S. in terms of diseases there. There's also an epidemic disease called Middle East Respiratory Syndrome that occurs mostly in the Middle East, and there have been some deaths in Saudi Arabia. It has about a 25% death rate, and there was indeed a person in the United States that had it who did that person die or did that person get better?
I don't remember.
But
it's, you'll see the nickname MERS.
It's called MERS, and I believe we have an article on the website about that too.
Absolutely.
Yes. So there's always something that's going to be a risk to the average person. But the average prepared person, the person who takes precautions, doesn't panic, but plans, that is the person that's going to do well and is going to keep their family safe in times of trouble.
And in the worst scenario, if you're prepared, you can shut the front door. And that's it.
Yeah.
And you are not going to get it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Oh. All right. Real quick, how's your board game going? Because me and Mike are pretty avid gamers, and I didn't have the funds at the time to get in on the Kickstarter, but I was debating if it's out for sale, I might go ahead and pick it up and just follow a little bit. So tell me about that.
Well, our board game is called Doom and Bloom Survival, and it takes place in a post
Pandemic.
Post-pandemic, like a post-Ebola world. If everything went wrong with Ebola, then basically you have the scenario that our game is in. The game is, I think an awesome game. It teaches a lot of tough decision-making that has to occur in a true survival situation. You accumulate resources, you scout out potential safe havens, and you're constantly tempted during the game to use the resources you've accumulated, even though you know that you can't win the game
right.
without having a certain amount of them.
Yeah, you have to balance. And should I expend these or should I save them? What's my better decision here?
Exactly. The game allows you to try. It's not one of those like Monopoly style games that you just go around the board. It you can travel in any direction at any time. And it has, there are bonus cards in the game that give you different types of game-changing effects.
And they're secret for the player, so no one else knows what your bonus cards are, and you can play them.
Each character starts with their own
resources
yep. based on their profession. There's a character named Amy Alton.
Nurse.
In there, and she's the nurse in it, and
Barton Bones.
And the game is actually has already been delivered to our backers in the UK and in the European Union, and it's
almost
going
here.
And it's actually almost here. We're going to be sending out several hundred games to our Kickstarter backers, and the game is available for pre-order if you go to our store at store.doomandbloom.net. And we should have it to people sometime in September.
Oh, I'm definitely going to have to get one of these, go along with my gaming collection. This is just such a unique concept. I've never heard of anything like this before. Definitely going to have to pick it up. We might actually spend an episode of this show just playing the game.
That was my plan.
We'll do a live gameplay.
That's cute.
Hopefully I win.
Hopefully you'll get to play a lot of bonus cards, because that's when everybody gets either really mad or really happy, is the bonus cards.
It's such a lack of, like, good prepper-type games. Because I've wrote articles before about, there'll be a lot of hard work, if we ever have any sort of a collapse, but then there'll be a lot of really boring time, too. It'll be all this hard work, and then it'll be all this downtime, and no one wants to snap out and go crazy from being bored.
Well, I think it's a great off-grid option. It's a great for the people like you who have a non-electronics day.
Yeah, it's a good family game.
And it's a super family game, and it teaches preparedness, and it teaches a survival mindset without cramming it down people's throats. And, lots of times we meet that lone prepper who can't get the rest of the family on board, and this is a great way to get them around the table and have a fun time, but at the same time learning about some of the tough decision making that has to be made in survival settings.
Awesome. All right, well, that's all we got for you guys. We finally got through this interview.
technical difficulties. Oh my goodness gracious.
Let me just tell you something about James. He's not a man who loses his cool too often, but he looked like he was about ready to put his head through the wall after that third disconnect.
And then, you know what? We came up with a solution and a plan, and we stuck together as preppers, and we made it work, right?
Exactly.
And knocked out an amazing interview.
There you go.
I just want all of our listeners to remember their book, the second edition of which is coming out, the Survival Medicine Handbook, a book that should be in anybody's commune, community, bug-out location, and bug-out bag.
Yeah, and then I have a review for it for a couple years ago, so you can read that and hear my high recommendation on it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Just want to remind everybody to head over to it was doomandbloom.net.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I keep wanting to say bloom and doom. I keep getting it backwards. But doom
and
bloom.
It's okay.
Doom and bloom. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. Dr. Bones, Nurse Amy, thank you so much for coming on to our show.
You have anything mention before we leave?
Well, that they can listen to our podcast. We call it the Survival Medicine Hour. It comes out every week. You go to the website and just click on the main page, the podcast button on the toolbar. You can see a bunch of our previous shows and listen it in at your convenience. We have a YouTube channel called DR Bones Podcast, pretty unimaginatively. and we have lots. And we have some Ebola articles, Ebola videos.
Video
on the ZMAP drug also awesome. That they might want to watch.
Awesome. I'll include links in the show notes. And thanks for being on, guys.
All right.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Our pleasure.
You want to.
Anytime. Do you guys want to say some closing words?
You got anything?
Do I got anything?
Kind of on the spot. Oh no, I just before I shut this recording off. I don't want to cut you off.
We're good. We interviewed we recorded some preamble that we'll splice together.
Okay, cool. All right.
Yeah, we got our normal closing stuff that we'll just
All right, I'm going to shut this off then.
We're going to send